This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern Thursday said that violence and extremism in all its forms is not welcome. Speaking at a national remembrance service in Christchurch to commemorate the 50 people who died in the attack on two mosques 2 weeks earlier, Ardern said that the memory of those lost and those who survived brings a special responsibility.
But with that memory comes a responsibility. A responsibility to be the place that we wish to be. A place that is diverse, that is welcoming, that is kind and compassionate. Those values represent the very best of us.
Dozens of representatives of foreign governments joined Ardern in the service, which was held in Hagley Park near the Noor Mosque, where 40 of the 50 victims were shot and killed by suspected white supremacists on March 15th. The Venezuelan government of President Nicolas Maduro said Thursday that it has stripped opposition leader Juan Guaido of the right to hold public office for 15 years, a sharp escalation of the political unrest in the South American country. Comptroller General Elvis Omoroso announced the political ban against Guaido.
At a rare public hearing, Mike Conaway said...
He said that Guaido, who invoked the country's constitution in January to assume the interim presidency, had inconsistencies in his personal financial disclosures, and he was spending more than his income would seem to allow. Soon after the announcement on state television, Guaido said that we're going to continue in the streets to protest Maduro's hold on power. Guaido, the leader of Venezuela's opposition-controlled National Assembly, is recognized by the U.S. and 50 other countries as the nation's interim president. But Maduro has clung to power amid power blackouts, street demonstrations led by Guaido, and widespread poverty and more. This is VOA News. Influential figures in Washington are calling for the establishment of a bilateral free trade agreement with Taiwan, even as U.S. and Chinese officials move toward a resolution of their long-running trade dispute. There is the thought that trade negotiations between Washington and Beijing will likely conclude within the next 60 days, at which point a full-force push for a bilateral full trade agreement with Taiwan could begin. Those talks would be more or less independent of what's going on. An estimated 10 million people in Afghanistan, more than a quarter of its population, are facing severe acute food insecurity and are in need of urgent life-saving humanitarian assistance in the wake of recent floods and drought. That's according to an international relief agency. 3 years of drought have contributed to massive crop failure, economic hardship, hunger, and loss of life, and forced more than 266,000 people from their homes, according to the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. In the outgoing month of March, it noted that extreme weather deepened extreme hardship when above normal rain and snow fell on soil with limited vegetation. The UK Prime Minister Theresa May has put her job on the line for the Brexit deal, but her Northern Irish allies are still saying no to that vote. Reuters' Lucy Fielder.
If it's third time unlucky in Parliament, Britain could Brexit in chaos without a deal in 2 weeks' time. To prevent it would require an extension request, with some new plan in mind. A debate in Parliament has now been set for Friday. May's sacrifice worked wonders with some of the hardline Brexiteers within her Conservative Party, who've now promised a yes vote, hoping to have one of their own at the helm in the next phase of Brexit.
And if the Prime Minister...
worried Britain won't leave at all if it dallies too long.
Four people have died in Comoros during a gunfight at a military camp where the police had detained an opposition presidential candidate. VOA Swahili service reports that at least seven people were injured. Police arrested Salihi Mohamed, one of 12 politicians who ran against the president, Azali Usumani, in Sunday's election. Police also took into custody more than a dozen women who were protesting against Azali's government. Salihi Mohamed had been named head of an opposition transitional authority that aims to replace Azali. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, March 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission says claims of stolen $2 million funds, Ebola funds, are unsubstantiated.
We are cocksure that the claim that $2 million were lost was circumstantial, was unsupported, and really was not founded on proper banking regulation.
U.S. President Donald Trump extends DED for some Liberian immigrants. Cameroon security forces are accused of rights violation. The U.N. says Somalia is not ready for a large-scale return of refugees from Kenya. And IGAD countries agree to ease the free movement of refugees in their countries.
It is African and humane to receive a person who is running from danger and treat that person with dignity for as long as that person stays.
Ruhakana Rugunda is Uganda's prime minister, and South African police dogs search for cyclone victims. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's post, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Back in 2017, the International Federation of the Red Cross, IFRC, claimed that its auditors found more than $5 million Ebola funds were lost in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea due to fraud. It said $2 million of that amount was missing in Sierra Leone through an apparent collusion between Red Cross staff and local bank workers. But Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission says its investigation found that the IFRC's claims of fraud were speculative and unsubstantiated. Chairman Francis Ben Kaifala says his commission is continuing with its investigation into whether Sierra Leoneans might have played a role in any misappropriation of Ebola funds.
What we have to understand and what the people of Sierra Leone have to understand that we are not saying that there were not corrupt practices in the management of the Ebola funds generally. We are generally investigating into almost all Ebola funds claims. But one of them is the IFRC claim, the claim by the International Federation of Red Cross. And this, our finding, is specifically in respect of that claim. We are cocksure that the claim that $2 million were lost was circumstantial, was unsupported, and really was not founded on proper banking regulation.
The International Federation of the Red Cross, the IFRC, that your commission believes that the financial delegates of the IFRC are very crucial in the investigation. Now, what would you like to see? Would you like to talk to these people or what?
Yes, the unfortunate part of all of this is that in our investigation, we have requested from Red Cross to make them available, and Red Cross got back to us to say that only one of them is working for them. The rest are no longer working for them, so they cannot really guarantee bringing them to Sierra Leone. But we have said that, firstly, we are 100% sure that the money was not corruptly lost due to any action of Sierra Leoneans. But if we are to take this further, we have to speak to these finance delegates to understand two things. One, why did they not open an account with Standard Chartered Bank, which was your preferred bank? Two, why did International Federation of Red Cross know that the Sierra Leone chapter was banking with a bank which they did not authorize, but they nonetheless proceeded to transfer $25 million in 26 transactions and did not pick it up that their preferred bank was not used? Thirdly, and most importantly, how did they do the negotiations so that they could not make sure that the optimal exchange rate is used for the IFRC? Our hypothesis is that they may have been negligent. But to be negligent does not necessarily mean you are corrupt. So these are all things we want to speak to them to be able to establish their mental state at the time when they actually acted on behalf of IFRC.
Mr. Chairman, as you know, the Ebola epidemic affected not only Sierra Leone, but Liberia and Guinea specifically. What lessons do you think these three countries can draw from your findings?
Well, I think that for a very long time, we have simply accepted things that other people present to us. So, for example, PwC comes to Sierra Leone and says that Ebola money was stolen from Sierra Leone, or Ebola money was stolen in Liberia, or Ebola money was stolen in Guinea. These countries can follow our footsteps. Do a forensic audit and analysis of their claim. It is not because you want to prove that they are lying, but for you to know the truth of what happened. Like they say, the truth shall set you free. We are trying to make sure that the truth sets our people free so that we can learn our lessons from it and know how to engage if we have future situations like this.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much again. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much, James.
Francis Ben-Kaifala is the head of Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission. He was speaking with us from the capital of Freetown. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has reversed its own decision to terminate by March 31, 2019, the humanitarian protection and relief for Liberian immigrants. The administration announced last March that it would end the Deferred Enforcement Departure, DED, because the humanitarian and military crisis in Liberia had improved. But a White House release said Thursday that while conditions in Liberia had improved, the foreign policy interests of the United States warranted affording an orderly transition period to Liberian DED beneficiaries. Winfred Russell is a Liberian immigrant and a city council member of Brooklyn Park in Minnesota. He says he's happy about the extension, but the fight continues to get permanent residency and full citizenship for all DED holders.
I'm excited and I'm really relieved, I think is a better word, because there have been a lot of anxiety in the community, I mean, across the board, not just in Minnesota, where we have the largest concentration of Liberians and DED holders, but across the U.S., there's a high level of anxiety among our people. So, frankly, I'm relieved. But I don't want to be overly excited because even though we've won this battle, the fight continues for permanent residency and full citizenship for all of those who are holders of DED.
As you say, these people on DED and TPS, they have been living in some kind of anxiety. Is this enough?
Well, we will accept this, but truly it's not enough. 1 year gives us some time to find a legislative fix for this problem, but we cannot continue to put our people through this annual extension and annual issue of stress and anxiety and all of that. And so they give us some time to find a legislative fix, because if you remember, we have taken the Trump administration to court. We filed a lawsuit in Massachusetts. That lawsuit continues. So we will be attacking this issue from all of the different angles and all of the different points that we need to ensure that ultimately we get full citizenship for Liberians who are DED holders. So, yes, this gave us some time to work with Congress to pass a comprehensive immigration bill that will cover DED and even those Liberians and other Africans who were given TPS as a result of the Ebola crisis. So all of those people will be covered on a comprehensive immigration bill. And so that's where the fight is now. But for now, we will accept this one-year extension of the wind-down period President Trump gave us. But we're going to continue marching on. We're going to keep pushing because we need a permanent fix. We cannot continue to have our people endure this year in and year out. This is unacceptable.
Winfred, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you.
Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Winfred Russell is a Liberian immigrant who was elected last year to the city council of the city of Brooklyn Park in Minnesota. He spoke with me from Minneapolis, Minnesota. A new report from Human Rights Watch says Cameroon's military has killed scores of people and burned down hundreds of homes in its campaign against separatists in the country's Anglophone regions. Cameroon is rejecting the report as grossly biased. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Tout d'abord, ce communiqué de presse du ministre de la Communication.
Le gouvernement tient à préciser que les forces de défense et de sécurité.
This is Cameroon State Radio CRTV reading a communiqué in which government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi says troops fighting separatists in the country's northwest and southwest regions have remained professional in protecting its citizens.
Ces forces de défense et de sécurité présentes dans cette région en proie aux attaques régulières des hordes de sécessionnistes.
The message says although soldiers present in the English-speaking regions have been victims of relentless attacks from separatist forces, they have not stopped protecting people and their property, and that in no situation have the forces torched houses or indiscriminately shot at its citizens. The acts of bravery and patriotism exhibited by the soldiers is exemplary, the communique state. The message has been repeated over and over in reaction to a report by Human Rights Watch accusing Cameroon's military of killing scores of civilians using indiscriminate force and torching hundreds of homes over the past 6 months. The report says that in one case, Cameroonian security forces attacked the village of Abu in the northwest region and burned an entire neighborhood to the ground. The report includes satellite images and photographs as evidence. The report also says armed separatists have assaulted and kidnapped dozens of people and executed at least 2 men amid intensifying violence and growing calls for cessation of the northwest and southwest region. All kidnapped victims were released, most after a ransom was paid, according to the report. Ilaria Alegrozi, senior Central African researcher for Human Rights Watch, says that since October, at least 170 civilians have been killed in more than 220 incidents in the two regions.
We have accounts from victims with material evidence, including photographic and video evidence, satellite imagery showing the destruction of homes, and also medical records. Ahead of the publication of this report, we have also shared our findings with the government, and we have sought its response, which we have incorporated. Nevertheless, we do maintain our independence and impartiality.
Alegrozi says Cameroon government should respect human rights instead of complaining about the report.
We understand that the government might not share all our findings, but we firmly stand by these findings and we stand by the victims of abuses we documented and whose rights we want to see protected.
Human Rights Watch is calling on both the government and the separatists to restore the rule of law and bring peace that has been absent from the English-speaking regions of Cameroon for 3 years. The unrest began in 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers demonstrated against the growing dominance of French in the officially bilingual country. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, March 29th. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. Member countries of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, have been meeting in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, to find ways to help improve livelihoods of refugees and their host communities. They agree, among other issues, to ease free movement of refugees as well as equip refugees and their hosts with skills necessary to improve their livelihoods. Mugumi Davis Rakorinch reports from Kampala.
At the end of 3-day meeting in Kampala involving donors, IGAD member countries resolved to work on ways to improve the livelihoods of refugees and of their host communities. Ambassador Mahbub Maalim is the executive secretary of the IGAD.
We are going to take stock of the Nairobi Declaration. It was holistic to find out how much we have done. Two, to recommit the countries to continue to do their part on issues that they have committed themselves to. Three, to lift out issues of education for the children of the refugees and issues of livelihood for the refugees. And fourthly, and not the last, the whole aspect of how we can blend issues of refugees and how to give them an enabling environment to live in our countries.
The Nairobi 2017 Declaration calls for protection and durable solutions for refugees and the reintegration of returnees. There are more than 68.5 million refugees across the globe, according to the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. While in Kampala, IGAD members agreed to, among others, develop, review and amend policies and legislations that allows free movement of refugees and asylum seekers. They also agreed to simplify procedures for refugees to access employment opportunities. Henk Jan Bakker, the Netherlands ambassador to Uganda, said his government had committed more than 1 billion euros for 6 years to help refugee activities in 8 countries, including Sudan, Uganda, Kenya and Ethiopia.
We need to operationalize the nexus between humanitarian aid and long-term development. Skills development turning into jobs are essential because they provide economic opportunities not only for the refugees but also for the host countries.
Maureen Achieng, the chief of mission for the UN Migration Agency, the IOM, in Ethiopia, agrees.
Supporting them to become self-reliant is critical and can have three beneficial effects.
Ruhakana Rugunda, Uganda's prime minister, says his government will continue to open borders for people fleeing conflict from their countries.
It is African and humane to receive a person who is running from danger and treat that person with dignity for as long as that person stays.
Uganda is now home for more than 1 million refugees and asylum seekers, many of whom are from neighboring countries, South Sudan, DR Congo, and Rwanda. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinjini, Kampala, Uganda.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says a large-scale return of refugees from Kenya's Dadaab camp could exacerbate the humanitarian crisis in parts of Somalia. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is aware of the renewed call by the Kenyan government to close the Dadaab refugee camp, which houses some 230,000 people. The UNHCR senior regional spokesperson for East Africa, Dana Hughes, notes this has happened before. As in the past, she says the UNHCR continues to work with the Kenyan government to implement a long-term and sustainable solution for the refugees. These include resettlement in third countries, family reunification, as well as the relocation of some refugees in other parts of the country. She says some areas of Somalia are relatively safe for returns to take place. But speaking on a telephone line from Uganda, she tells VOA in most cases, repatriation is too dangerous to consider at this time.
Most of the areas that the refugees from Dadaab come from can't be considered stable for any kind of large-scale return. And in fact, it could exacerbate the humanitarian crisis that exists in those parts of Somalia.
Hughes says 12 areas in Somalia have been largely pacified by the African Union and other forces. She says UNHCR continues to assist people who voluntarily want to return there. She notes more than 82,000 refugees from Dadaab have gone back since 2014. But in general, she says, large parts of Somalia are not ready for the massive return of refugees.
While Somalia has made some progress in development over the last few years, it still is a country that has had decades of war, which means decades of a lack of infrastructure, is still rebuilding itself. So, of course, any sort of large-scale return would not aid the ability that Somalia is trying to build.
Hughes says the UNHCR is thankful to Kenya for the generosity in hosting the Somali refugees for decades, despite the toll it has taken on the environment and other aspects of life. She says her agency is having ongoing discussions with the Kenyan authorities about the possible closure of the Dadaab camp. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South African police sniffer dogs have been sent to parts of Zimbabwe hit by Cyclone Idai to help look for those who are missing and presumed dead. Survivors of the storm hope to find the bodies of their loved ones and give them a proper burial. Columbus Mavunga reports from Chimanimani, about 500 kilometers southeast of Harare.
Let's go. The South African police officer guides his sniffer dog in Ngangu, one of the areas west hit by Cyclone Idai in Chimanimani district, Zimbabwe. The area has been engulfed by putrid smell, which locals believe could be decomposing bodies trapped under the earth. 35-year-old Wanda Tom had his grandmother lost when Cyclone Idai hit the area on March 16. He hopes the sniffer dogs will help them find the 82-year-old's body so they can give her a proper burial.
Because they can help us to discover our relatives. Because I think here in our country we don't have those special teams that can treat the bodies or the covered bodies. We don't have machines to see that on this ground, under this ground, there's somebody who's trapped there. So it relieve all of us to retrieve our relatives so that we can bury them nicely. Although they are already, their bodies are buried, but it's better for them for us to take them and bury them nicely.
Almost all of the 330 people missing from when the cyclone hit Zimbabwe are from Chimanimani district. Ian Hoy is traveling with the South African Police Sniffer Dog Team. He says they will be in Chimanimani for 5 days to search an area with a radius of about 60 to 80 kilometers.
Columbus Mavonga reporting from Chimanimani in Zimbabwe. It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting, here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with the 2019 CAF Super Cup match between Esperance de Tunis and Raja Casablanca, scheduled to be played at the Thani bin Jassim Stadium in Al Rayyan, Qatar, later this evening. Esperance qualify for the annual match as the 2018 CAF Champions League winners, having defeated Egyptian giant Al Ahly in the final. The Tunisian giants are heading into this encounter undefeated in their last 16 matches in all competitions. Esperance will be making their fourth appearance in the Super Cup, having won the trophy once in 1995. Meanwhile, Raja Casablanca qualified for the prestigious game as the 2018 CAF Confederations Cup winners, having defeated DR Congolese giant AS Vita Club in the final. Staying with football news, Ghana Deputy Minister of Sports Perry Okudzeto says they are looking forward to meeting with Ghana Blasters coach Kwesi Appiah to discuss his AFCON 2019 plans.
We're looking forward to meeting him and the technical team to review so far the qualifiers, review the friendly game we played yesterday, and then to look forward into what plans he has for Africa, and then providing the leadership from our side as to what the roadmap is, where we're going to camp the team, what facilities we're going to go to, what countries will be within the zone in which we will camp, and what friendly games we can be able to arrange for the team.
For coach Kwesi Appiah, it appears he already knows his squad to the CAF AFCON 2019 tournament.
I know my team. I know the team that I've taken AFCON. The only thing is, maybe there may be injuries along the line. They may be sicknesses, and then some of them, their form may drip. So it's important to take note of all these things. I don't think we have any mercy around somewhere. You know, what we have is what we have.
Elsewhere in South Africa, Bafana Bafana coach Stuart Baxter says he wants his side to develop an identity based on resilience and toughness at the 2019 African Cup of Nations. South Africa defeated Libya 2-1 last Sunday to ensure the progress to the main competition from Group E, along with Nigeria, who topped the standings. Coach Stuart Baxter says he does not want to put the players under unnecessary pressure.
And I've said to the players, I've said, when we go to Egypt, I want you to tell people this is South Africa.
Finally, in rugby news, Kenya Sevens head coach Paul Murunga on Thursday named his 12-man squad for the Hong Kong and Singapore series in the World Sevens Rugby Series. Murunga named former skippers Andrew Amonde and Eden Aguero in his squad after the duo plus four other senior players returned to training, having boycotted training in protest over slashed salaries earlier this week. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend, and we look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, March 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. Join us again Monday for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. This week, I talked with three co-hosts of VOA's newest roundtable discussion show, Our Voices, which focuses on African women's points of view. It's the first time VOA has produced content exclusively driven by female journalists on serious topics affecting the continent. That's Press Conference USA, Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. What's the latest on the political crisis in Venezuela? Are President Nicolas Maduro's days numbered? And how will Washington's relations with Brazil, given the leadership of newly elected President Jair Bolsonaro, nicknamed the Trump of the Tropics, change? An update on Latin America, that's Encounter, Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.